and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us. We have a really great show tonight that I'm actually almost having palpitations about doing because it's such an important topic to me personally. Tonight we have with us Brenda Dunn. She and Robert John started the Princeton PEAR Lab, the Princeton Engineering and Anomalies Research Laboratory, and have done years of work in hard science on the topic of consciousness. So tonight we're going to talk about their book, Quirks of the Quantum Mind. And just to give you an introductory, this book does not offer a quantum mechanical explanation of human consciousness. Rather, it proposes something far more radical, namely that quantum mechanics, like any other model of human representation, is both a reflection and a product of the mind, and is fundamentally intuitive, describing a reality of which we are an integral component. And that's actually a little blurb on the back of their book, which gives a good definition. Thank you, Brenda, so much for taking the time to come on, and I can't wait to get started because I have a million things. But if you want to give us a little introduction of who you are and what PEAR Lab is, that would be great.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting me, Eva. It's so good to talk with you again. And I think your program and your book are very important contributions to this ongoing debate on the nature of human consciousness.
Thank you.
As for who I am, from 1979 until 2007, I served as the laboratory manager of the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, or PEAR, laboratory, together with Professor Robert John, Dean Emeritus of Princeton School of Engineering and Applied Science. We did many, many experiments exploring what originally started out as a question of whether human consciousness could affect the behavior of random physical systems. The question was really stimulated as an engineering concern. If there was something to this, as had been reported in some of the parapsychology literature prior to that time, then engineers ought to know about it, especially as we moved into increasingly more delicate and sensitive technology. And so we carried on this work for nearly three decades. Primarily, the work addressed questions of, or had two experimental programs. One we called Human-Machine Interactions, where individuals, human operators, were asked to try to affect the outcome of a random event generator in accordance with a pre-recorded intention to go in one direction or another. The other part of the program explored a phenomenon known as remote viewing, or what we call remote perception, where people attempted to acquire information about remote geographical locations where another person was situated at an assigned time. And there, our focus was on trying to develop analytical techniques that would enable us to quantify the information that might be acquired in this protocol. The third part of the PEAR program was a theoretical one, in which we looked at the results that we obtained in our experiments and asked the question, what's going on here? If what we were seeing was right, and it did seem to be over databases of many millions or tens of millions of trials that produced statistically significant results, then something was wrong either with our experiments or with the theoretical concepts that drove much of modern science. In particular, many of these experiments showed that people could influence the output of the random event generators from remote distances at times other than when the machine was actually physically operating. And the remote perception experiments also showed that people could acquire information in a way that was not dependent on physical space or time. Needless to say, this was somewhat problematical. How do you explain something like this? And so we attempted to develop a series of conceptual models that might help us to understand what was going on and tell us what the right questions were to ask. One of the efforts, in fact, the earliest one, was a technical report that Bob and I wrote way back in 1983, which we called On the Quantum Mechanics of Consciousness with Application to Anomalous Phenomena. This paper was published in an abbreviated form in Foundations of Physics a couple of years later. And it was summarized in our two books. The first was Margins of Reality, which was published back in 1987, and the other was a more recent book published 2 years ago called Consciousness and the Source of Reality, the Pair Odyssey, and these summaries bore the same name as the original technical report. Unfortunately, it seemed to us that for those people who read it, they seemed to be getting the wrong idea. Not everybody, but many people seemed to be under the impression that we were giving a quantum mechanical explanation for consciousness. That was not what we were trying to do. And so this past year we decided that we would put our hands to another book that would attempt to take this conceptual ideas that were in that report and reissue them, update them a bit, and include a fairly extensive appendix that we had prepared early on of quotations from many of the founders of quantum mechanics who clearly had been raising some of the same questions, namely, how does consciousness fit into this? Now, you know, many people are familiar with the so-called observer effect in quantum mechanics that maintains that an effect doesn't exist until it's observed. Very puzzling. It's been the source of much debate and discussion among theoretical physicists over the years. But the underlying assumption for so much of the work that had been done in this area was that somehow consciousness, our minds, were an epiphenomenon of our brains. That is, it was our physical brains that produced the experiences of consciousness. The concepts in this book and in the earlier versions of it say, no, we think it's the other way around. Quantum mechanics, or indeed any model that the human mind can construct of the physical world, can tell us as much about the mind that is experiencing that environment as it tells us about the environment that's being experienced. And as such, quantum mechanics is as much a description of how our minds order and organize our experiences in ways that make sense, that we can represent and share with other people. Now, that was a very long-winded introduction. I hope that made some sense.
It's great, actually.
But that's the gist of it.
It brings up a couple of basic questions that I need for you to define for us. One, and I'm going to give you all the several questions so you can answer them how you please, all in one breath if you want. We need to know define consciousness.
Take a deep inhalation, right? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I have like 20-something questions for you. We don't have to get to all of them. And I have to be careful to not go down the rabbit hole with each of them, but I do think that they're good ones. So, first of all, what is consciousness when you're talking about that? Second of all, from what you just said, you made me think that you mean that brain and mind are not the same thing. So if we could define what those things are so people understand what's not controlling what or what is controlling what. And the last thing here is objectivity and subjectivity. For people that don't know what you mean when you use those words or those phrases, what are you talking about?
Okay, well, I think I could possibly answer the last question with the first one,
okay.
Namely, what do we mean when we speak of consciousness? Consciousness has many interpretations. A lot of people think of it strictly as the activity of our minds that is deliberate, that is driven by cognitive processes and intellectual neurophysiological activities. We take the position that consciousness is much broader than that, and that it encompasses not only the conscious, so-called, activity of our being, but also the unconscious, the subconscious, the collective conscious, any activity that somehow is associated with the subjective domain, namely me. Okay? When I speak of myself and my own personal experiences, I would refer to those as subjective. When we think in terms of things that are not me, we can refer to that as objective. And therefore, consciousness represents this ongoing dialogue between the I and the not I that we all engage in all the time. So the subjective is the personal experiential dimension of experience. The objective is the quantifiable, shared, linguistically defined experience of what's out there.
Okay.
Now, what was your second question?
mind, brain.
Oh, yes, of course. As I mentioned earlier, many people tend to think of mind or consciousness as something that is produced by the brain. Again, we disagree with that definition. We think of the brain much as you might think of a television or a radio. You know, I'm sitting here in this room and surrounded by a plethora of frequencies and amplitudes and signals and so forth that are swarming around all over, all the time. They are not accessible directly. But if I have a television set or a radio, I am able to tune that set to a particular frequency and amplitude, and I can pick up signals that correspond to those frequencies and amplitudes, and they become manifest in a physical way. Our brains, as we see it, are like the television set. They're very important for transforming these ephemeral waves of potential into something tangible and perceivable. But they don't produce it. And that's the big difference. Our brains don't produce consciousness. Our brains are transmitters,
process?
Receivers.
Okay.
Excuse me?
I was going to say, does it process that information?
I'm sorry, I missed what you said again.
That's all right. Just go ahead. I thought you were stopped for a moment, so I asked a question. It's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. But just basically, we are talking about, you know, this metaphor of a television set and the programming is a good one to represent what I'm trying to say. The brain is the television set without which we would not have the physical sensory experience of these signals, okay? But it isn't the source of the signals, and that's the big difference. In another sense, I might add, I think one of your other questions said, you know, what is consciousness? Let me go back to that one. One way that one could represent it is that consciousness, rather than being a thing, is a process. It's an organizing principle whereby we are able to access all of the information that surrounds us in our physical environment and translate it into something meaningful. We can tune these channels, if you like. If we're talking about, you know, one topic, let's say we're talking about trees, I can pick up all kinds of information and all of the information either I already know or I see around me that are associated with trees. And as such, I will not pay too much attention to the color of my rug or, you know, what I'm going to have for dinner. So we sort of tune in to a particular topic or concept, and we then take the information that comes in through that channel, whether internal, subjective, or external, objective, and we try to make sense out of it. We assign it names. We use language to translate those experiences into something that we can communicate with other people in some form or another.
Okay. Remembering that I have 20 questions, so to speak.
Oh, I thought those were the 20 consolidated.
I'm going to ask this one question here, and I know probably that what your answer is going to be no. But I have to ask because I know that my listeners would want me to ask this question, and they probably wondered the same thing. Do we know how, or even have a clue, how consciousness became?
No.
Okay. That's what I thought, but I had to ask it because I know they would want to know, you know?
Yeah. Okay. There are theories about it. There are some people who say that it is a process that arises as a result of increasing complexity in an organism. As it organizes itself, it also organizes its relationship with its environment. And in that exchange between self and environment, consciousness emerges. But we don't know how, and we really don't have any definitive answer to that.
Okay, the next set of my questions, it's going to go in the chronology that I thought about them when I was reading your book. And so some of them you may have already answered, and I'm not aware, or my audience may not be aware that you've answered them, so I'm just going to ask some questions that I know that my audience would want to know. Because most of my audience is going to be somewhat knowledgeable about consciousness, and a lot of them are dying to know what is the science behind it. So the first question is, remember that I'm not the scientist, so I word my questions the best that I can, so hopefully you'll make some sense out of it. What is an atomic collision, and what does the difference between predictions of wave mechanics and classical particle mechanics mean to us? Is that a logical question, or does it make sense?
Okay, well, in classical physics, the world tended to be represented, the physical world, in terms of little particles, atoms, electrons, whatever, that bounced around, and they would collide with each other, shoot off a photon, or, you know, create some form of radiation. Sometimes they might bond together and become a molecule. Okay, so if you have, say, two hydrogen atoms that come together, and if their spins are of opposite directions, they might create a single new system, which would be a hydrogen molecule, which now had two nuclei and two electrons spinning around these two nuclei, okay? Now, with the advent of quantum mechanics and many of the anomalies that arose out of classical mechanics as physicists began to study these smaller and smaller dimensions of experience, the atomic scale level of reality, anomalies were, you know, emerged, things that didn't quite behave. In particular, sometimes these atomic systems behaved as if they were particles, namely little tiny physical bits of matter, okay, that had certain properties, a nucleus, an electron, a whatever, okay? But other times, they behaved as though they were waves. And it seemed that the determination of whether this system behaved like a wave or like a particle had a lot to do with the way you set up your experiment to observe them. So if you set up the experiment looking for atoms, looking for particles, you would see particles, and with all of the properties of particles, mass and momentum and all of this, you know, the things that little bits of matter tend to have. If you set up your experiment to look at waves, you didn't see these. Instead, you saw frequencies and amplitudes. The question was whether these atoms were waves or whether they were particles. And ultimately, the reconciliation of this dilemma came about in the work of Niels Bohr, who developed the complementarity principle, and Werner Heisenberg and his uncertainty principle, which said basically both of them were correct. The wave and the particle were the same thing. They were just two different ways of looking at it, two different ways of representing it. Now, already there's consciousness for you, right? We decide whether we're going to represent this event as a particle or as a wave. And they're not two different things. This was a major breakthrough, and lies at the foundations of modern quantum mechanics and this observer effect.
It makes me... Well, let me just ask the question so I don't put words in your mouth. Is it an analogy, would it be that whether you see the big picture or the little picture in life as it relates to life, our lives?
Because
I'm kind of wanting
more a matter of, yeah, that's more a matter of scale. My favorite analogy for that is my grapefruit representation of the universe, okay? Let's say you have a grapefruit and you slice it down the middle and you look at it and you see these patterns of radiating, you know, wedges, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you cut another grapefruit and you see it again and you go, oh, great, this is what grapefruits look like. Now you pick up another grapefruit and you slice it on a different axis and instead you have a very different pattern. Are there two different types of grapefruit? You can then ask the questions of what's the probability of the grapefruit being this form or that form. But the fact of the matter is there's only one kind of grapefruit, and what you observe depends on how you cut it.
Gotcha. Okay. So my next question, I'm going to ask that question, and you can answer it however you want to with the science. because I'm so intrigued by that. But also, I know that you are, I don't want to say you are anything, but I know that you're interested in the mysticism of spirituality. I don't know how to word it, but
mm-hmm.
I'd like to know what you think about that too, okay? What is meant, well, you talked about uncertainty and complementarity principles, so you covered that. But then you talk about what is meant by the graininess ensues in the definition of that reality as an inevitable consequence of the interaction of the observer with the observed. So I want you to talk about the science, if you need to, but also I want you to talk about how you think that we use this in our lives and how we can use this to change our lives. And
well,
remembering
I think
that
we
I
use
still have
it
10 more questions.
Yeah, I think we use it all the time. I think we have two fundamental ways of interacting with the world. One is descriptive. It's the objectifying of the world and the assigning of names and numbers and so forth. The other one, which taps into that more mystical or spiritual dimension, is the direct experience of the world. When we become one with whatever it may be, an event, you know, it's like being in love. Somehow or other, the phenomenon of being in love changes the I plus you into a we, and that we has different qualities and characteristics than either I or you, if that makes some sense. We become a we. And we might experience the same phenomenon differently together in a shared way than we might as individuals. But we are trained and we tend to emphasize the objective part. It's our social structure, our educational emphasis. We're very big on measuring things, and much science is dedicated to things that we can measure, things that we can put numbers on.
Well, that's my
next
question.
There are some things that we experience that you just can't put numbers on. Love is one, beauty, or the direct experience when I feel my consciousness merging with that of another creature, or with the cosmos, in a deep meditative state. We can't really measure that. That isn't something that lends itself to a quantitative description. It's experiential. It is purely subjective. And that's really, but we do both. We are capable of doing both. We
that
are designed to do both.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay. Werner Heisenberg once gave an example of this of uncertainty and complementarity. When we choose between sitting back and enjoying music or analyzing its structure, they're two totally different ways of experiencing music. And according to his model, you can't do both of them perfectly simultaneously. If you do them both, you're going to have to sacrifice some of the enjoyment for the analysis or some of the analysis for the enjoyment, or you can go purely into one domain or the other. Both of them are there. We have access to both. We
That's
choose.
A great analogy.
Okay? Well, it's not mine. It's Heisenberg's.
It's great. I never thought
but it is
that,
a great analogy.
So could that possibly be the reason that when some scientists do experiments, they get different results? They're not in the same zone. I don't know what to call it.
Yeah.
You know, like
yes,
Emoto's work. Emoto gets one thing, and somebody else comes along, and or even your random event generator work. You know, some people it won't admit that there's an effect when because they can't do it. Is it because of their level of awareness? Or I don't know how to frame that question.
It has to do with one of the underlying assumptions of modern science, namely what's called replicability. Many scientists will maintain that an observation or a measurement is not acceptable unless everybody who does the experiment gets the same result every time. However, there are a lot of subjective variables that come into play in any experiment. The time of day, the mood of the experimenter, the expectation of the experimenter, the ambiance of the room, you know, the air pressure, the temperature, you can control for many of the objective measurable variables, but there's a lot of variables you can't control for. And particularly when you're dealing with subjective variables, they aren't even acknowledged most of the time. So it's not surprising if you get different results from different attempts to measure the, quote, same thing. Now, most of the time, the differences are small enough that they can get swept under the rug. But when you're dealing with probabilistic systems, which is, of course, what a random event generator is producing, probabilistic outcome, you know, it's like flipping a coin. It has an equal likelihood of being a one or a zero. Then you're dealing with something that could go either way. You may be familiar with the metaphor of Schrödinger's cat. Erwin Schrödinger proposed a thought experiment in which you put a cat into a box, and in the box there's a pellet of some kind of poison gas, and some random process determines whether that pellet will be activated or not. If the pellet is activated, the cat's going to be dead. If it's not, the cat's going to be alive. But until you look inside the box, you don't know if the cat is alive or dead. It's in what's called a state of superposition, which, funny as it sounds, means the cat is both alive and dead at the same time, until you make your observation. So, you know, whenever you have a process that entails some degree of uncertainty or probability, your likelihood of direct replication becomes less and less predictable. And if one wants to go a little further, one could make the argument that ultimately just about everything in our physical world comes down to a probabilistic system. Certainly in quantum mechanics it does, but it does in sociology, it does in economics, it does in biology when you're talking about, evolutionary processes. They are probabilistic. You cannot predict with absolute confidence how a particular event is going to come out. And we would say that wherever you have this kind of uncertainty or probability, the mind has an opportunity to somehow enter into the picture and ever so slightly alter the outcomes in accordance with its intentions or its expectations or its preconceptions and so forth. Now, of course, one thing I've always found rather funny was that Schrödinger and those fellows never took into account the consciousness of the cat. I have to presume that the cat has a survival instinct, which might actually influence the probability of whether that pellet gets activated or not.
Well, of course you would think that. That's so great.
It takes us a little bit of feel, but...
Okay, here's our next question. I'm just going to read this direct out of your book. Please explain this. It is not clear whether the consciousness distance grid scale is universal or varies from individual to individual. What is meant by the same number of bits of experience of information are uniformly required to accomplish a given transposition, or whether different individuals invoke fewer or more steps for the same purpose? You mean there's some science about
why some people have tougher lives
than the others?
Yeah, I can't speak to the, quote, science of this, but the common sense of it says that if I'm an expert on some topic, I have a lot of knowledge, And I can draw on that knowledge to interpret an observation. If I am a novice, I might need more information before I can come to some conclusion. Two people who are, quote, on the same wavelength, people who are close, who are bonded to each other, might share enough experience that they, you know, they know what the other person's going to say, or they know what the other person means without having to go into a detailed description. But when you're talking to a stranger, you might need more bits of information to communicate what it is you're trying to say. So in that sense, it is a subjective thing. It depends on the state of knowledge. It depends on the shared information base that the two communicators might have. And it also, of course, would depend on the complexity of the system that you're observing.
Okay.
So it will vary from one observation to the next, or one topic to the next, or one person to the next.
Also, I should have asked you from the beginning, what is consciousness distance grid scale? What is that thing?
Well, in the book, we go into some detail talking about how all of the metric qualities that we use in science, distance, mass, charge, time, have both subjective as well as objective aspects. And indeed, most of the objective dimensions were drawn originally from subjective experience. You know, how large is a foot? Well, originally, a foot was the length of a step, okay? Well, of course, different people had different size feet, and so you weren't going to get complete accuracy. And then you come along and you say, okay, we'll measure it and call it so many inches or meters or centimeters or whatnot, and try to try to come to some agreed-upon measurement system that when we speak of a foot, we don't have to ask whose foot. We took many of these qualities and sort of turned them inside out to say, what do these tell us about the consciousness that is doing the measuring? The physical world that is being described by a consciousness, by a human mind. And in that sense, these descriptions might tell us as much about how the human mind operates and interacts with its environment and its experience as it can tell us about what it is that is being interacted with. So, once again, it depends on whether you're speaking in terms of the objective or subjective aspects of your measurement.
Okay.
In science, we like to have objective, regular, agreed-upon measurements, and the idea that these can vary from one person to another is disturbing and complicates absolute replicability, doesn't it?
Yes. So my next question is something that I haven't read about since I read Jane Roberts' Nature of Personal Reality years and years and years ago. What is the consciousness atom? I found that so interesting that it's in this book.
Oh, what is the consciousness atom? Again, I have to emphasize that everything we've done in this book is metaphorical, okay? We're drawing metaphors. We're not speaking in the sense of physical reality, okay? So the consciousness atom would be an individual experience of consciousness. Let's say there's a something we call I. That is at the center of the universe that I live in. And it interacts with its environment in a number of ways. It can do it in the way that the physical atom, by radiating, sending out a photon or colliding or whatever. But the consciousness atom would be the unitary entity that comprises the individual consciousness. I'm having a little bit of difficulty trying to say that briefly.
That's all right. Well, let me add on some part to the question, and maybe that'll help.
Okay.
Because I have put two things right there together, or three things, actually. So I'll just read these questions, and maybe it'll help my listeners follow you along better. What is the role of charge, or what are these things, and electrostatic attraction and their relationship to the ability of an individual consciousness to center itself on a given mortal body? And further, a charged system of either signs tend to seek their opposites. What does that mean to our lives, and does it, and can it be manipulated? In other words, can we change the charge of our lives? And then the last part of that question is, are there any neurophysiological and biochemical mechanisms that play any role in charge?
I'm sure there are,
but I
don't know what they would be. But going back to the first part of your question, again, a metaphor. Everything I'm saying is metaphor. Let's assume we have something we call a spirit or a soul, okay? Some non-physical essence of existence, of my being. And that soul somehow interacts with a physical environment that I would call my body. Okay, so at the moment of however you want to define it, conception, birth, etc., that soul becomes embodied. And the body and the spirit become one thing. So the body is going to reflect that spirit. The spirit is going to influence the body, whether in its physical characteristics or in its behavior. Can we change it? Well, it depends on how hard you want to work. I believe that we can, and many of the age-old, you know, spiritual traditions say that we can learn this. Many of us feel we can't, and we just become automatons being determined by outside influences, thinking we can't change things. But we can change things. If, you know, you've ever been in a negative state of mind, and the world around you is looking ugly and, you know, hopeless, and you could stay there if you like. You can choose to stay there, or you can make an effort to break out of that view, that worldview, that perspective, and take a different orientation, a different way of looking at it. Well, you could look outside and you can see a little bird, for example, on a tree, and suddenly, you know, you're not caught up with your own stuff. Your consciousness, your spirit is drawn to something outside yourself. And maybe the bird's song will alter your mood. I mean, it's so hard to describe this in any specific way, but I think most people would recognize this. You know, there are some things in, what's the old prayer? Help me to accept the things I can't change, to change the things I can, and to have the wisdom to know the difference. I probably cannot change the configuration of my body. I'm going to have two eyes, even if I want three, and I don't think I could force myself to grow a sixth finger on my left hand. But I can decide how I'm going to use that hand. If I'm right-handed and I, for some reason, temporarily or permanently lose the use of my right hand, I can learn how to write with my left hand and brush my teeth and, you know, do things that I never could do before. We can change certain aspects of our physical reality. by working at it, by our desires, by our intentions, by our effort. Some things we can't change. I've kind of lost the thread
That's
of
right.
where I was going with that.
I have one question I'm going to ask you. I've got a bunch of them, and we only have about 12 minutes left, so I'm going to ask this one, and then you can have the rest of the show to talk about whatever you want to talk about. And while I'm thinking about it, I just want to bring up the fact that I'd like everybody to take a look at my webpage. It's evaher.com. And my Facebook page, it's called The Eva Her Show. Because I wrote a new book recently, and Brenda Dunn and Bob John is the first chapter in my new book. It's called Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics. It's 11 interviews with, started out with maybe 50 or 60 scientists, but I culled it down to 11, and I'm just trying to bridge the gap between the scientists about what they think and the research that they're doing, so they'll all know one another exists, and also between religion and science, because I think religion causes war sometimes, so maybe if they realize that we're all one, the warring might get a little bit better. But Brenda and Bob, or Brenda's interview, is the first one in the book, and I think that you would like it. So my next question is,
Let me interject there. And give a little plug for your book, which I have read.
Thank you.
And it's not just because we're in it, but it is fascinating reading. I love the way it gives many different perspectives on this topic of what is consciousness. And I think the only way we're going to come to understand what consciousness is and what it does and how it works is if we can take a multidisciplinary approach to it and look at it from many different points of view. So your book is a contribution to that, and I thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you so much. I tell you, one of the things that I think is so important that came out of that book, Bill Tiller called me when I sent him his copy. I don't know if I told you. Did I tell you this story?
I don't recall. You have to run a few bars first.
Well, Bill said, I love this book. I think it's one of the most important books I've ever read, but I hate it. And I went, why? And he said, because everybody doesn't say what I say. And I went, especially about what is the definition. And he said, I have researched with so-and-so for 30 years, and I never knew that's the way he defined consciousness. So he said, I'm retired, I'm 82, I think he said, I can't remember what age, 80-something. He said, it tells me that I have to come back out, that I have more work to do, because I thought we were all on the same page and we weren't. No wonder we didn't get along sometimes. So,
well, you know, in my world, or the way I see the world, it seems that if one wants to be a scientist, in the true sense of the word, of acquiring new knowledge and learning things, there are two very difficult things that one has to be able to say. One of them is, I don't know. And the other, which is even harder, is, I was wrong. And, you know, if we don't take a risk of making a mistake, you know, we're not going to learn. If we start out thinking we've got all the answers, and we already know everything that needs to be known, then why bother doing science?
He actually said something like that to me. He said, you know, Eva, when I read this, I had to step back and ask myself, is the problem that I'm having here with Eva, or is it with myself? And I finally came to the conclusion that it was myself.
We all have our preconceptions and our idea of the way things are, and it's built up from many years of repetition, of habit, of expectation, and what we've been taught. It's very difficult to step back and say, hey, maybe it's wrong.
Or more.
It doesn't come easily. And I think that's why many people in the sciences are uncomfortable with the phenomena of psychic effects, because I've heard people say many times, well, if what you're doing is right, then everything I've done must be wrong. And my typical answer would be, no, it's not wrong, it's just incomplete.
Yes.
You know, back to the grapefruits, there's other ways of cutting it. There's other ways of looking at it. And in fact, this is really what we tried to do with this book, was to say, let's take another look at the concepts of quantum mechanics. Let's ask what it tells us about the mind that organizes its experience. Let's see how we can get a glimpse of how we, as conscious beings, make sense of the world, instead of presuming we already know how the world works. And when we did that, and we developed all of these wonderful metaphors, which was loads of fun, by the way, we ended up with what I regarded as a non-physicist, as the my own background was in psychology and the humanities. And when Bob explained some of the basic principles of quantum mechanics to me, I said, what you're talking about is the psychology of subatomic particles. And in many ways, if one is open enough to consider that possibility, quantum mechanics, or indeed any other model, whether it be scientific or religious or economic or social or anything else, is a glimpse of the way we function. It is a reflection of ourselves. We determine how the world is going to be interpreted. And sometimes it can be as a wave, sometimes it can be as a particle. This is one of the most important contributions, I think, of quantum mechanics, is that one doesn't have to choose between one and the other. One can accept the fact that both are right, and that it just depends on how you choose to make your measurement or how you choose to interpret what it is you're looking at. So, you know, that's essentially what we were trying to do with this. The book does have a lot of equations in it, and it does, at one level, look to be very technical. But if you kind of get past that part and read between the lines...
I just skip that part. I just skip the...
Yeah, just skip the equations.
The reading's great after you do that. You have to read slowly, though, but it's great. It's great. It's a wonderful book.
The equations are there for those people who think in those terms. It's a way of representing. But even that, you know, we speak of mathematics as the queen of the sciences. But mathematics is a consciousness project, product. Mathematics is conceptual. You know, there's no numbers out there. We assign the numbers. We assign the measurements.
Symbols.
We interpret them. Yeah. We assign these symbols, and then we somehow come to some agreement on what the symbols mean most of the time. Properly speaking, we should come to an agreement on what the symbols mean under such and such circumstances. It would make more sense that way,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely. I have one more question, and we've got 4 minutes, probably 3.5 minutes. It's a hard question, probably, but you can choose to answer it, or you can choose to talk about anything that you think that needs to be talked about that we've not talked about. So here's the question. What is the importance, or what is the hadron molecule covalent bond analogy? What is the importance of that? Just tell us what the importance of it is. What does it mean to our labs?
Okay. In the very beginning of the book, we actually give a little anecdote on that topic. As I said, I had no background in physics when I met Bob John. And in one of our very earliest conversations, he asked me, what do you think is actually going on in these phenomena? And I said, well, I think what happens is two people or a person and some external event somehow come into interaction and they start to share information. And in so doing, something bigger comes out of it that's neither the one nor the other. And Bob nodded and he said, do you know about covalent bonds? And I said, no, what's a covalent bond? And he then described how the covalent bond works. And using the example that's typically given of hydrogen, because it's the simplest atom that has only one nucleon and one electron that sort of is perceived as sort of spinning around or creating a cloud around the nucleus. And when you bring these two of these atoms, these hydrogen atoms together, something very strange happens. If their so-called spins are in the opposite direction, and we assigned a metaphorical definition of spin to a yin-yang dynamic, that is, you know, a generative or receptive mode, then these two atoms come into resonance with each other. And they become a molecule, which now has two nuclei and two electrons, but the electrons are sort of going around the two nuclei in almost, try to imagine like a figure eight configuration, okay? Now, the interesting part about this is you can't tell which electron came in with which nucleus. You have lost some specific information about the specific atomic components. But what happens in exchange, if I use the term, is an anomalous component that is known as an exchange force. And what that exchange force is telling us is that the overall energy of that molecule is stronger.
Producer just tapped in and said, we got to go. It's 9 o'clock.
Okay. The energy of the molecule is greater than that of the individual atoms.
Promise me you'll come back. Where can we find you on the Internet? What's your website?
I'm sorry. Our website is icrl.org. ORG, International Consciousness Research Laboratories.
And thank Robert John for going out on a limb. Please
All right.
Back.
Well, thank you, Eva. It's always a delight to talk with you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.